We are going to delve into the fixed income world and whether we are seeing some of the same caution that is being expressed elsewhere in fixed income as well. For that, we bring in Rick Rieder. He is the Chief Investment Officer of Global Fixed Income at BlackRock. Rick, it is always great to catch up with you. We've been talking a lot this morning about how we've been seeing equity strategists cut their S&P 500 forecast. And there does seem to be a bit of a shift in tone and sentiment coming from strategists more broadly. On the fixed income side, how are you feeling? I mean, we do see kind of fixed income markets take tapering expectations in stride up till now.
So, I mean, and thanks for having me. So I'd say a couple of things. First of all, I run large equity portfolios as well. So, and the dichotomy between the two is pretty extraordinary. I mean, I would say first thing was, how is the fixed income market taking, you know, tapering? Or, I mean, it is to say in stride is an understatement. The amount of supply that's coming to market in investment grade credit last week, $75 billion was priced in 4 days. By the way, there were Jewish holidays in there as well to price that much. High yield, the loan market is pricing immense amounts of supply. The treasury market, we had treasury refunding. Markets are having no problem with the Fed taper. In fact, the Fed taper and the discussion of the Fed is so insignificant. Well, we're talking about $15 billion a month. We got $75 billion of riskier investment grade supply in 4 days. It's just not, you know, people don't put the sheer size of it, you know, particularly when a Fed is delinking rate from the quantitative easing program. It's just, the markets are in good shape. The demand for income, the demand for return, I've been doing this 35 years. I've never seen this extraordinary amount of demand there. So, by the way, so I do run big equity funds. I actually think the equity market, I think I haven't read this Goldman piece that y'all were referring to, but you look at what revenue growth is, you look at what these companies are building book equity at 20, 25%, 30% per annum. And you think about that, gosh, the intrinsic value of my stock is going up 20, 25% per annum, whereas the 10-year note yields 1% with real rates at negative 1%. It just puts into perspective the paradox between value in the fixed income market and the equity market today, where I don't think equities are high by any measure.
So, Rick, what accounts for all of this demand that you're talking about? I mean, is it, people like to point the finger at the Fed, of course, and say, oh, it's because of all the liquidity in the system and it needs a place to go. Is that what's going on here? Is there something more to it? It seems like that seems overly simple. I don't know.
Fed is the no doubt. I mean, in fact, I think the Fed is creating an overcrowding dynamic, particularly in the front end of the yield curve. There's not enough collateral to fulfill the amount of that the Fed has to put into the system. So I do think the Fed is over enhancing the amount of liquidity in the system, but it's so much bigger than that. We're going through a demographic evolution and a need for income. And by the way, that is extraordinary. Pension funds, insurance companies, by the way, not just domestically. You look at Japan, you look at other parts of the world that have a need for yielding assets where don't have the inflation rates we have here. That amount of money. And by the way, as the equity market runs up, people look at balancing their portfolio and say, gosh, my equity just became a bigger portion of my portfolio. I need to reduce that and I got to buy more fixed income. So the demand for yield and income, and by the way, this is not a temporary, this is part of why I would argue the Fed tapering would have a more than an insignificant effect on us in the near term, because particularly since the system is overstuffed with liquidity. But the demand for income is going to be something that is going to be the hallmark of this investment decade, without question to me. I mean, it's just, I mean, and when you look at the sheer size of wealth that's been created, and we look at, by the way, the consumer today, part of why I think growth is better than people, forward growth will be better than people think. Consumer has not only built up huge amounts of savings relative to history, but it's also paid down their debt, and their house is in much better shape than it's been before. So consumers in great shape, the need for savings and expenditure will be strong from here.
Rick, why do you think, just looking at the equity component, why do you think investors are ignoring some of these correction calls we've gotten lately?
So first of all, there's too much money. I mean, the amount of, and you know, not only is there too much money, the alternative is not attractive at all. And so what's happening, and by the way, much of the way we're running our big unconstrained portfolios is, gosh, I don't want to own a lot of those quality assets that the Fed is putting at rates at prices that don't make sense. So you hold more cash, but then you can get more equity upside. But also, I think there's something historic that we're going through. When you talk about these companies building book equity as fast as they are, and you look at the earnings yield of the equity market or the free cash flow yield, even what I think, I think coming from a credit side, I like free cash flow yield better than anything. I mean, we're seeing more and more companies throw off the average of the index is over 4% earnings yield, just above 4% free cash flow yield. Those numbers are incredible. And when you could build book equity as fast as you can, and then you think, okay, so what's my fundamental backdrop? You know, people look at prices and say, well, actually, we're at records. And I always find like a record, but if you're building book equity that fast and you're throwing up that much earnings yield, these multiples are not high at all. There are some stocks that are too high, but the overall aggregate, level of valuation is not bad in an environment, particularly where a big part of how you build a balanced portfolio, i.e. safe quality assets, is too rich. So there's a natural inclination. Let me get into more of those assets. But I don't think they're overpriced today, in general. I can find a few that you wonder why people are buying.
Rick, you can always find those, I think. Rick, what's going to happen with rates before the end of the year? And is that going to change the valuation picture of stocks? Because that's really one of the key areas, the key risks that we're hearing strategists these days point to, is that rates are going to go up, and that's going to be bad for a lot of American companies.
So, I mean, we agree that rates should move moderately higher. But, rates have moved higher this year. From, think about where we started this year. I think the 10-year note got down to 51 basis points or so over the last 12 months. And so rates are higher than where they've been. I think rates are going to go higher. These real rates are not priced right. I mean, if the Fed, takes their foot off the gas a little bit, rates could move higher. The Treasury is issuing to fund the fiscal expenditure. The amount of coupon supply, Treasury supply is higher. So I think rates can move moderately higher. But then you got to step back and put it in perspective. How much higher are rates going? Gosh, I think the 10-year note can go up 30 basis points. Maybe next year we get a few more basis points on top of it. You go back and think about that in time. Let's say the 10-year note is going to be at 1.5%, 1.625%. You think about historically what that means, and particularly what that means relative to, you've got two things happening. One, you've got historically low interest rates, not as low as they were a few months ago, but pretty darn low. And then you've got book value accretion or return on equity growth that is actually at all-time highs. So to move rates up 30 basis points is nothing. I mean, if it happened in a day or a couple of days, people take a step back and say, gosh, I've got to readjust. I've got to think about this. But it's not going to come on the backside of the Fed announcing they're going to taper. I mean, each time the Fed comes out, quote unquote, more hawkish, markets take about 2 hours to interpret it, and then they end up doing well again. So, gosh, I think you have to put in perspective this level of interest rates, and rates are just not going to go that high for me. They're just not.
Hmm. And Rick, switching gears a bit, I think we were talking to you earlier in the year when BlackRock was just studying or looking at crypto and how it might get involved. Where does the firm stand at today? Where are you involved in it aggressively? Are you looking at it, and where do you think prices can head from here?
I mean, I have small pieces in a couple of my big portfolios, and I view it as similar to when I own a, venture capital, or say, we don't do a lot of venture, but second stage, a growth equity holding in some of my portfolios. Gosh, I think it could have some real upside. My sense is there's more buyers than sellers. It is an asset class that I think is durable. Listen, is it a hedge? Not really. It doesn't correlate with debt or equity. When people say it's a hedge, it's a monetary policy hedge. Don't know. I mean, I see answers for that are on the plus side, negative side. So we own small amounts of it. And, it's quite frankly, I'm glad I do, because this helped me learn about the evolution of what I think will be a blockchain technology that will continue to grow. So it's something I'm glad I got involved with, but it's not driving portfolio return relative to certainly my equities or my fixed income holdings.
I love it that at your stage of career, you can invest in something as an educational opportunity. I think that's great. I think there's a lesson in there for all of us, I think, Rick. It is great to catch up with you. And I hope
Thanks
we'll see you
me.
Again soon. Rick Rieder is Chief Investment Officer of Global Fixed Income at BlackRock and also the head of the BlackRock Global Allocation Team. Thanks so much, Rick. Appreciate it. There's a big change at the top for one of the world's largest hotel chains, BWH Hotel Group CEO and President David Kong, is retiring at the end of the year after nearly 20 years in that role, the longest-serving executive in the industry. Kong spoke exclusively with our Akiko Fujita about his decision and why he's choosing to step away right now.
First of all, I'm not retiring for good. I like to think that I have some runway left. I'm just looking to leave Best Western after 20 years. It's a long time. And during that time, we've done so many amazing things and built such wonderful platforms. The company is in great shape, has a great foundation. And I always want to leave at the peak of my career. And last year, as you mentioned, was the most challenging time for just about anybody's career. And we've not only survived it, we've excelled. The company actually did extremely well. We didn't have to tap into our reserves at all. In fact, we added to our reserves. And our guest satisfaction ratings are high. Our revenue production is great. So I'm leaving the company in great hands and in great shape.
David, I want to get into the state of the industry in just a bit, but it is worth noting on this occasion, 17 years in your current role, you started as a dishwasher, a busboy, if I recall correctly, in the industry. And when you think about the transformation for the company, at the time where you took on this role, you had one brand. Now you've got nearly 20 brands. As you look back on these years, talk to me about the transformation that you have seen in the industry and why you think the BWH Group has been able to stay relevant, especially within a younger demographic.
Yeah, very, very good question. Well, first of all, I am an immigrant. I came to this country with nothing. I have no friends. I have no connection, no money. I was a poor student. I had to immediately get a job as a dishwasher and busboy. And look at what's happened to me. I'm now the biggest, the CEO of the biggest hotel, one of the biggest hotel companies in the world. So it speaks to the dynamic opportunities this industry offers. It really empowers bold dreams and enables people to pursue those dreams without hesitations. I'm grateful to the opportunities the industry has provided. That's why I'm grateful to Best Western for affording me the opportunities to grow and prosper in my career. If you look back in the last 40-some years that I've been in the industry has changed a lot. But one thing that has remained constant is it's a hospitality industry. It's about people. It's about taking care of people that stay with us and taking care of people that work in the hotel industry. The industry has gone through many ups and downs, and it's always survived. It's extremely resilient and strong. And likewise, we are surviving this pandemic and recovering very nicely. At this time, things look bright. Technology adoption is something that the industry has not really embraced, but now because of the pandemic, it's speeding up technology adoption. So there are a lot of things that are happening that are very exciting. And it's just a great time to be in the industry right now.
Let's talk about the challenges facing Best Western right now. Labor, certainly front and center in the hospitality industry. You look at the most recent jobs numbers, zero jobs added in leisure and hospitality in the last month. There are more job openings than workers. How long do you think until you are able to fill the openings right now? And what does that mean in terms of the challenge this presents for the way with which you run the company?
The labor has always been a challenge for many years. And after the pandemic, it's an outright crisis at this point. And it's not just our industry, and it's not just related industry. It's almost in every industry. It's a problem. The fact that in the U.S., we have 10 million jobs open and unemployment rate is about 5.4 and 5.5%. When at one point we were at 3.5, you see what the problem is. There are people that are reluctant to come back to the workforce. So it's affecting many, many different industries. The hospitality industry needs to reinvent itself in the way that we compensate people, in the way that we pay, in the way that we provide benefits to be more competitive, because right now we're not competing with the same industry for the talent, but we're competing with other industries. Other industries, meaning Google and Amazon and the like, that are very generous in what they do. So we have to step up and be much more competitive in that sense. The other thing that we need to do as an industry is to reinvent our image. It's not known as an industry that provides a lot of opportunities, and people tend to think that they're going to be stuck in their jobs. But you look at me as an example, I'm a wonderful example to illustrate that industry actually affords a lot of upward mobility and a lot of opportunities for people that want it. So we have to get the word out that not only do we provide opportunities, but we also value diversity and inclusion. And you look at me, how I can move up the ladder. It's a great example. We just need to get the word out.
When you talk about the image of the industry, of course, we're talking about more of the traditional hotel names as we know it, but you've got competition from the likes of Airbnb. When you think about the way in which behaviors have changed over the pandemic, you know, Airbnb has said their long-term stay is the fastest growing sector for them right now. How do you compete with something like that when the demand in terms of how people use hotels and stays have evolved over the course of the pandemic?
Yeah, I've always thought of Airbnb as a big disruptor. It is really in many ways forcing all of us up our game. And the reason Airbnb can say that is because of the remote workforce that's been prevalent after the pandemic. A lot of people, like today, I just talked to someone who was supposed to be working in Chicago, but is now in Hawaii, has been in Hawaii for 3 months. He moved there 3 months ago and he's working remotely. And that organization didn't even know. So Airbnb is empowering that kind of work arrangement where people are in some ways allowed to work remotely or encouraged to work remotely. So it's empowering that to happen. But in the long run, I think we will each find our space. There are people that are reluctant to stay with Airbnb for a variety of reasons and are more comfortable with amenities as well as the safety and security that hotels provide. So we would each find our niche, and in the end, I think things will work out. But I welcome competition. I think the industry wants it, and it's a way for all of us to provide a better experience and improve the guest experience.
And David, really quickly, going back to what you just said, you said the competition isn't just, you know, others in the industry, but you're competing with tech names like a Google. Are you starting to see some of that migration, the traditional labor pool you would have tapped into? Are they now moving away from the industry?
Yes, we've seen even in our company, when we had the pandemic and regrettably had to lay off some people, many of them actually went to work somewhere else. They went to work for Amazon or Walmart or even Google. It's not just in technology, but a lot of even entry-level positions that we used to be able to tap into, that talent's being siphoned off by them. So I'm already seeing that, and I think that would continue unless we improve the way that we compensate people and provide those upward mobility opportunities.
House Democrats have a plan circulating today to raise the corporate tax rate on companies with income of at least $5 million to 26.5%. Now, that's below President Biden's original proposal of a 28% level. Let's get some more information on all of this with Gina Raimondo. She is, of course, U.S. Secretary of Commerce. Secretary Raimondo, thank you for being with us this morning. So, as I said, 26.5% is what we're looking at now for companies that make at least $5 million annually. Is this something that the president can live with, even though it's a bit lower than his original proposal?
Good morning. The president has been very clear from the beginning that he's open to compromise. And so this is part of the legislative process. I'm sure that, you know, we're going to continue to negotiate and we'll see exactly where it lands. The important thing is the president's Build Back Better package is good for business. You know, it makes the investments in job training, infrastructure, broadband, child care that businesses tell me every day they want and need in order to be competitive. So we're negotiating now in good faith with Capitol Hill. The president himself is very engaged, and we will see where we end up. But the important thing is that these investments happen because they're good for business and good for American families.
And I know that's an argument you made most recently to a group of business leaders in Cleveland. I was looking through your remarks there about the advantages that you say are going to be in this plan. You, as you said, you talk to a lot of business leaders. You talk to those folks in Cleveland. I know that you're close with other executives, the likes of Mark Benioff, for example. What are you hearing from them? Traditionally, businesses don't love higher taxes, right? That's sort of conventional wisdom. But what are you hearing from them in this case?
Well, you are correct. People don't love higher taxes, and we don't expect that business would love higher taxes. However, when I talk to business leaders, they are very focused on being competitive, competing on the global stage. And in order to do that, they say, and I agree, the president agrees, we need investments. We need a better trained workforce. We need workers who have digital skills. We need every American to have broadband and to be digitally literate. We need childcare that is affordable. You know, I hear from businesses all the time that women are not coming back into the workforce, or they're offering promotions to women, but women are saying they can't take the promotion because they can't find high quality, affordable childcare. So if we're going to compete, if American business is going to compete, we need these investments. And then the question is, how do you pay for them? I don't know any business leader who thinks that it would be responsible of the president to operate this government as if he had a blank check. You know, they don't run their businesses that way. You make investments and you pay for these investments. So there's room for negotiation, to be sure. And that's what we're doing now. We're negotiating. But it's crystal clear that this package is good for business and makes investments that will improve businesses' ability to compete.
And Secretary, of course, you got negotiations happening in the business community. You have negotiations happening on the Hill, of course, as well. And there, it's going to be thorny, right? You have folks like Senator Joe Manchin, who has already talked about that he's not optimistic this is going to get done before the end of September, for example. How do you get this passed?
You work at it every day. No, this is all part of the process. This is the way every major piece of legislation happens. It's part of the process. You work it through, you compromise. But from our perspective, President Biden and us, his team, are committed to staying at the table to get this done. The American people need us to get this done. We've kicked the can down the road on these investments for too long, which is why our roads and bridges are crumbling, which is why a third of Americans who live in rural areas don't have broadband, which is why we don't have, you know, affordable pre-K for every American child. So it's time. Let's meet the moment. Let's compromise and let's make these investments.
And Secretary, on a related note, and something you alluded to has to do with reskilling workers, something that's also a part of the plan. Somewhat unusually for a Commerce Secretary, this has really been an area of focus for you. And as we know, employers added 235,000 workers in August. That was a much lower than estimated number. The most recent job openings numbers that we have from July show 10.9 million openings. That's a record. How much do you think reskilling can go toward closing that gap?
Significantly. It is significant. We have Americans who are smart and want to work. We have employers who can't find people to fill the open jobs. And the primary reason is that there's a skills mismatch. So right now, there's 500,000 cyber technician jobs available in America. And if you talk to business, they say, we just can't find folks with cyber skills. We can't find folks with digital skills, cloud computing skills, digital backbone skills. So, you know, the economy is changing at an incredibly fast rate as we move towards a more digital tech economy. And so we have to make sure that Americans have those skills. This is an area I have a lot of experience with. I focused heavily on it in my time as governor successfully. And I learned that in order to be successful, business has to be at the center of the job training. It can't be an afterthought. You have to start with demand. What do businesses demand and need? Who will they hire? And then create the job training initiatives to meet the demand. So the president believes strongly in this. Secretary of Labor and I are working closely on it. And businesses tell me every day, you know, help us find the skilled workers that we need to fill these spots.
And it really comes back to me, something that you mentioned earlier, which is being competitive on the world stage, whether it's the skills gap, whether it's paid parental leave, whether it's universal pre-K. Are you hearing, do business leaders in America feel that they are at a disadvantage because there are not these kinds of policies? I mean, certainly on an individual level, they could be implementing some of these measures, but do they feel like the U.S. government needs to be their partner in this?
Yes, absolutely. And they are disadvantaged. You know, the Build Back Better agenda of the president's calls for much greater investments in basic research. If we're going to be competitive and lead, we need to increase our investment in technology and innovation. If same thing for job training, same thing for childcare, you know, same thing for affordable healthcare, supply chains. We are all struggling with disruptions in supply chains right now, most particularly semiconductors. President's package is calling for a $50 billion investment to shore up our semiconductor supply chain. That is unquestionably good for business. And if we don't make that investment, businesses will not be able to compete on a global stage. So as we said, we'll go through this process. There is room for compromise. We're making great progress, I should say. I am confident we will get there. But these investments are necessary in order for American businesses to compete. And it's just the right thing to do for American families.
Secretary Raimondo, thank you so much for taking some time out to speak with us here this morning. I know it is a tough slog in Washington to get this bill through. Gina Raimondo is the U.S. Secretary of Commerce. Thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
For more on maybe all of these moves, obviously, as crypto becomes larger and larger in terms of traditional investors looking at the space, I want to bring on a man who crossed over along with me. Rick Edelman here joins us, Edelman Financial Engines founder. And Rick, we all know you've been focused squarely in on this space, and we've been watching it closely. Last week, you know, the drama had been around the SEC and Coinbase and what they were looking to maybe step up in policing. But where do you put us right now in this adoption cycle? I wonder if that maybe cooled what you see there in terms of investors really looking at Bitcoin as a hedge and traditional investors leaning in on that space.
I'm not sure if it's a hedge. I think it's a diversification tool, Zach. And I think that we're seeing the adoption of mainstream Wall Street engaging in this. Corporate America is recognizing that there's a there. You know, when you've got big, huge companies like MassMutual investing $100 million and its CEO joining the board of a major crypto player, NYDIG, you begin to realize that this isn't just for the fringe any longer. But the big thing holding everybody back is the lack of regulatory clarity. So there was a lot of applause in the crypto community when Gary Gensler was named chair of the SEC. The assumption in the crypto community was that, hey, this guy taught blockchain at MIT. He therefore is a big fan of this space, and he'll readily move forward with regulation and approval of a Bitcoin ETF, blah, blah, blah. Instead, what they're getting is a sound, careful individual who indeed knows the space so well you can't fool him. And he realizes that adult supervision is needed, and we're going to see some regulatory clarity in months to come. And that's going to be really good for the space overall long term. It's going to get the fringe even more to the fringe, and it's going to allow the main players, those with the trillions in assets, to engage in this space with confidence.
Yeah, one of those big updates in terms of Gary Gensler and what people have been waiting on is the approval of a Bitcoin ETF. Of course, they have those in other jurisdictions, Canada being the one closest to us. But when you look at that, he was, I guess, floating the idea of approving one tied to Bitcoin futures, not necessarily underlying Bitcoin, which would be pretty different. What's your take on maybe how that wouldn't be as exciting maybe as people in crypto were hoping for?
Yeah, it's a good move from a regulator's perspective because the SEC has clear jurisdiction over the futures market between it and CFTC. They can, you know, flex their muscles and guard consumers in engaging in futures. That isn't necessarily the case with Bitcoin, which the SEC has declared is not a security, therefore outside their jurisdiction. So unless Congress gives the SEC more control, it's easier for the SEC to say yes to a Bitcoin futures fund than to Bitcoin itself. But investors, as you noted, Zach, have to realize there's a big difference between buying an asset and buying a futures derivative contract on that asset. They are not always the same. Futures prices can move independently of the underlying asset. So if you're going to engage in a Bitcoin futures product, make sure you understand the difference and understand what you're doing so that you're not going to be surprised.
The other thing, too, that we always talk about is the way that analysts now are kind of looking at some of these other chains in a way that they might traditionally try and figure out whether where the price is going to go on a stock, right? And we can talk about Ethereum and a lot of those transactions getting built there, a lot of the fees that come associated with it, so-called gas fees, in these transactions exploding because of NFTs, non-fungible tokens. And you seem to be bullish on that space. I will say the majority of my weekend was taken up by discussing whether or not these things were here to stay, whether it's just fraud, similar to what you might see in the art space. But talk to me about why you think that that's important maybe for Ethereum and why you're a big fan of where NFTs are headed.
Well, Bitcoin led to Ethereum. Ethereum led to NFTs, non-fungible tokens. This is the future, and this is where all the excitement really is. Now, we could argue whether, you know, the apes are worthwhile or whether NBA Top Shot is worthwhile, basketball trading cards, and the artwork that you're seeing from Beeple and others. You know, if you go to OpenSea, you'll see thousands of pieces of art, all of it online. Is there a there, and is it nothing more than a Beanie Baby, the fad of the day? But that's not the point. I'm talking about the underlying technology here. NFTs are the future because we can tokenize everything. And when I mean everything, I mean your house can be tokenized. Most Americans, their biggest asset is their home. In retirement, how do they generate income from their home? Well, if you tokenize your house, you can sell shares of your house, NFTs, and generate income. You can tokenize your contract, so that you can have people investing in your career and your future. We'll be doing this with Hollywood actors and professional athletes. We'll be doing this with recording artists. You know, Bob Dylan has already sold his music catalog, so did Stevie Nicks. Wouldn't it be cool to invest in blood on the tracks so that every time the song is played on the radio, you receive a little bit of royalty? Everything and anything can be tokenized due to this technology, and NFTs are the future.
That's pretty fascinating to watch and see all the different use cases come through here and just which ones are going to be real. I do think that there is a lot of use cases, particularly when it comes to AR and clothing that's being sold. So you get a matching NFT for the clothes you wear in person and in the virtual world, perhaps, you know, years down the road, but still something exciting to think about. But Rick, lastly, kind of one of the things that is still getting pushback here in terms of the investment community might be the impact that all this has on the dollar remaining king across the globe as kind of the reserve currency in El Salvador moving forward with accepting it as legal tender, Bitcoin that is, does kind of raise questions about whether or not the demise of the dollar is upon us. I mean, you already look at, you know, the way that we've been able to increase spending but don't have necessarily the right funds there in place to back up some of that spending. What could happen to the dollar in this next chapter? As you look at it, how worried should investors be about some of that demise of the dollar talk now?
I'm not worried about it at all. All we've got to do is digitize the dollar. And so, you know, CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, we're going to see the Federal Reserve issue a digital dollar before the decade is out. Just about every government around the world is going to do likewise because they don't have a choice. You know, they can't stop Bitcoin and other digital assets. All they can do is regulate it and compete against it by launching their own CBDC. So the advent of Bitcoin as a currency, it's being used, as you noted, by El Salvador now. Other countries are contemplating it as well. To get El Salvador to stop doing that, give it a digital alternative, create a digital dollar. And that will preserve the American dominance. It'll ensure the regulatory environment that we all know and love because of the safety that it provides and therefore the consumer confidence we need for the financial markets to operate. All we got to do, if you can't beat them, join them. And the sooner the better.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there hoping that it is sooner rather than later, and we'll see what happens there. Of course, the SEC kind of kicking off maybe some of the questions around how quick they're going to be to move on this stuff. It's a lot to get to, though, so I do not envy their position. Rick Edelman bringing us the latest there with his thoughts. Edelman Financial Engines founder. Thanks again for the time, Rick. We've been discussing some overlooked challenges when it comes to production in the pandemic, but now one that may have been overlooked is being called out quite clearly. We're talking about Nike here, and we're seeing shares under pressure after Nike was cut, downgraded to neutral from buy at BTIG based on some supply chain challenges that the company might be seeing in Vietnam. And for more on exactly what those challenges are, happy to bring on BTIG senior analyst Camilo Lyon here with us today, the author of that downgrade, alongside Yahoo Finance's Reggie Wade. And Camilo, I mean, when we look into it, it's pretty severe in your words in terms of the impact for Nike. And obviously, they're not alone in seeing COVID really impact their supply chain. But how big is it when you put a number on it? And how worried should investors be?
Yeah, the work that we've done over the last 2 weeks really raised the alarms for us. You know, Vietnam represents about 50% of the production of footwear for Nike. And from the discussions that we've had with our contacts in country, that number was going to go a lot higher this year. That is until COVID-related shutdowns mandated by the government began about 2 months ago. So effectively, Nike's production factories, their factory partners, have had 2 months worth of lost unit production. The government has now talked about restarting and reopening the country. That's slated to happen on Wednesday, the 15th. But we think that that's going to be a very slow and methodical build in terms of getting that ramp up in production, which will likely equate to another 2 months worth of production loss. So when we talk about Nike, the scale of its business, the amount of units that we're talking about, we're looking at 160 million units of shoes that just won't get produced this year. And so that's going to have a consequential impact on its sales from what the work that we've done.
Camilo, Reggie Wade here. We know that Nike has tremendous ability to pivot within its manufacturing locations, but as you just stated, it might be too late for the holiday season. But are you more optimistic that they can make some of that up in the spring?
Short answer is no. Look, Nike is the best company in the world. It's also one of the largest. So when we talk about them shifting their production, we're talking about a battleship turning. It's a very long, drawn-out process. And in particular, on footwear, the complexities mount even more so relative to apparel. It's pretty easy to change, relatively speaking, it's pretty easy to change apparel production from one factory to another or another country, from one country to another. Much more difficult to do so with footwear. If you think about how many pairs of hands go into making a pair of shoes, it can be north of 30 people touching one pair of shoes, where for apparel, it can be like three or four people. So the complexities around labor, the complexities around the molds and the lasts and the machinery that have been in place in Vietnam make that transition, while not impossible, pretty darn close to impossible, at least in the very near term. The other thing to consider is if they were to switch production to a place, say, like China, the tariffs are still under effect, the tariffs that were imposed under the Trump administration. So then we're talking about an incremental cost to that transition from Vietnam to, say, China of about 30%. So really, there's not a great amount of quick remedy that we see unfolding. They can't raise, they can't shift production out. They can't keep more units to themselves to sell through their own channels and consequently hurt the wholesale channel to enough to maintain their guidance. In fact, the math that we ran suggests that that would be a pretty cataclysmic shift against the wholesale partners in their favor. And it still wouldn't make up enough of the lost production. So we're at a loss for ways of finding how Nike can quickly resolve this issue today. Now, it's not to say that they can't over time, but with low visibility and no real understanding of the timeline and the duration of the bottlenecks that have been created as a result, we felt it prudent to step to the sidelines.
Camilo, we know that vaccination rates are extremely low in Vietnam. Somewhere between 14 to 28% of the population are partially vaccinated. Do you think that Nike will start to push some of its Vietnamese employees to get vaccinated when it becomes available to try to mitigate some of this?
You know, we asked that question of our contacts in country to see if that was a plausible solution. And it certainly makes sense on paper. We know that Nike's actively in discussions with the government to come to some sort of resolution to open safely. The problem that becomes apparent, though, is if there is the perception of favoritism that is paid to, say, Nike factories versus others, if there's some sort of priority and maybe potentially some moral hazard issues that come about with that as a potential solution or a solve. The other issue that I think is less understood is, remember, the factories have been closed for about 2 months. That means that the employees of those factories, if they've stayed in the South in Ho Chi Minh City, haven't been getting paid, but they've had rent expense and they've had food expense. So a lot of them went back to their home provinces outside of the city. Getting them back to the factories before the new year, before the Lunar New Year, will be a challenge in its own right, let alone all the other issues that we discussed in terms of supply chain bottlenecks at the ports and container shortages, and just getting through the amount of product that is sitting in factories that is finished goods that still needs to get out and distributed globally.
Yeah, Camilo, to Reggie's point there, I guess, you know, there are other options. Nike's a big monster power player in the apparel space, and, you know, they could look elsewhere, but, you know, in a shortened timeline, difficult. And also, it's a pandemic. Every country is facing kind of the same concerns here. But when you kind of, you know, when you say 160 million pairs of shoes, when you put that into the stock price here, looks like you got fair value close to what, $152? So, I mean, how do you see it maybe impacting where the stock price could go once they get through all this?
Sure. So to frame it, you know, Nike guided to low double-digit revenue growth. This was back at the end of June before these issues in Vietnam had really come to the fore. The way that we ran our numbers and what we concluded was that low double-digit growth is probably closer, will probably be closer to flat to up low single digits. And what's been true for as long as we've covered Nike, dating back over 10 years and then even before that, its stock price has been most closely correlated to the direction of sales growth. And so when there's visible evidence and mounting evidence that sales are definitely on a decelerating path, again, not because of demand, but because of short supply, you know, in a best case scenario, the stock is flattish and will tread water until there's more visibility. And in a worst case scenario, earnings estimates will be revised down. The stock will re-rate lower. You'll have multiple compression and the likelihood of giving back all the gains that the company has earned this year increases. So, you know, to us, the lack of visibility and just the mounting evidence of things getting worse, not better, made the call a fairly easy one to make.
Yeah, a pretty easy one, but also a pretty dramatic one here in terms of the impact as we're watching it all play out. Appreciate you coming on to chat with us, though, about it. Camilo Lyon, BTIG senior analyst, joining us there alongside Yahoo Finance's Reggie Wade. Thanks again for the time.
Small and medium-sized business owners continue to be in survival mode. A new survey out by Salesforce shows more than 70% of those businesses survived the pandemic by going digital. Joining us now with more is Enrique Ortegon. He is Senior Vice President of Small and Medium Businesses at Salesforce, and we are also joined by Yahoo Finance's Danny Romero. So, Enrique, great to have you here. Let's dig into this Salesforce survey, because I know you spoke to 2,500 small and medium-sized businesses from around the world. What did they tell you in terms of how and where they are getting support right now?
Rick, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here this morning. And yes, listen, in the framework of the celebration of National Small Business Week, which starts today we released our fifth annual Small Business Trends Report, and we'll learn many things. One of them is, you know, small business owners and leaders, they're a resilient bunch. I mean, they find ways to succeed and to thrive in the hardest of times. And the last 18 months have certainly not been the exception. One of the things that we found out is when we asked them, how do you succeed? How do you manage to survive and even thrive through these hard times? 72% of them told us they did so by going online and adopting an online economy.
Yeah, and to that point, you know, I guess what were some of the methods, back to the study that you found that 71% of growing small business owners survived was through digital. How were they able to expand their presence online?
Yeah, so they did several things. The first thing they did, they prioritized their customer needs and their wants. And what they realized is customers want the option. They want the flexibility to interact with businesses and services, either online or in person. Earlier in the pandemic, what they did, they set up more digital channels like e-commerce, for example, and they provided offers like, contactless delivery, and they're keeping those offers alive. E-commerce continues to be increasingly adopted by small and medium businesses. The other thing that they did also, they turned and focused on what I like to say, both sides of the counter. So they look and they look at their employees. Their employees now want more flexible work arrangements. They want to work from home. So what they're doing also, they're investing in collaboration and productivity tools for their own employees, so their employees can be productive and can engage with their peers and with their customers anywhere they want. They want to be successful from anywhere.
And what are those flexible, I guess, working arrangements? Because that's something that your survey also found, that like 50% of small businesses found that, by having flexible work schedules, it allowed them to grow. So what will we see more of that? And what are the demographics to that?
Yeah, so absolutely. What we found is include several things. One, the ability of workers to work either 100% remotely or partially remotely, being able to come to the office whenever it's the best time for them. It can be one day a week, it can be 3 days a week, or it can be being fully remote. The other thing is working different hours. We think and we saw that the 9-to-5 is dead. Right now, employees are able to engage with their customers and with their work in the times that are most convenient to them. As we all suffer here in our pandemic, right? Some of us have children, have occupations at home, we're all here in our houses. So we're finding that we need to find that work and that flexibility to be able to be productive at a time that is better for us. So what customers are doing, again, they're giving their employees the tools to engage digitally and the flexibility in their schedule, right? And in their time to be in the office to fit their employees' best needs.
And now back to the government support. Obviously the small businesses needed it. Like you said, it's been instrumental for them to survive. What are the types of aid that they really benefited from, and do they need more aid?
Yeah, absolutely. So we went back and we said, you have it right there. I mean, we asked them how important was government assistance, how important was community support. And 69% of the leaders we talked to said government assistance was very important. 67% said community support was very important. Actually, 1 in 10 told us that they would not be around hadn't it been by a combination of government support and community assistance. So that's why we're very happy to see that, for example, the Small Business Administration is increasing the size of their loans for $500,000 to $2 million in their economic injury and disaster program. And again, in a week like this is Small Business Week, it's an opportunity to celebrate and collaborate and support what I think is the foundation of our economy and the fabric of our society. A Small Business Week is an opportunity to go out there, consume small, buy small, support them, write a review, tag them in your social media channels, and continue to spread the love for our small and medium businesses.
And I know that this survey was global in scope. So how do small businesses in the U.S., medium and small businesses here in the U.S., compare to those around the globe right now?
Yeah, I think it's a global phenomenon. What we see is around the world, I wouldn't dare say there's a huge difference, right? That's one of the things that we found is the consistency around the globe. I mean, the digital economy is global. It knows no time zones. It knows no boundaries. So in different countries around the world, the adaptation and the adoption, right, the reinvention in a digital economy is consistent. So in that sense, we saw that, again, globally, the digital economy is real. 75% of the businesses, the growing businesses we spoke to, said the changes they did in the past is going to help them into the long term. So what we've seen is that, around the world, businesses will continue to adapt and to adopt digital tools to make their customers happier and their employees more productive.
All right, Enrique Ortegon of Salesforce, thanks so much. And of course, to Yahoo Finance's Danny Romero.